I thought we'd get the Saxo Horses, the horse actually.
Yeah, no, I've been chasing up this terascale simulation tools and technologies stuff. And quite like the approach that they have, although they're sort of really lacking in detail. So last week we were talking about the two different approaches that you can take to provide information about how meshes can be built up. One was the sort of minimalist approach where you specify a series of elements and element points and then provide information about the collocation, what element points are shared, and then build that up in a hierarchy so that you can do the same with points that are defined on an ensemble, etc., and join ensembles together. That provides you with a way of sort of linking parts of your mesh together in a proper sense. But that's all it does. It doesn't give you information about boundaries and what is how you specify boundary conditions. That's entirely left up to the the user's interpretation of how the mesh is assembled. So I mentioned last week also that this terascale simulation tools and technologies group has taken a slightly different approach at the other end of the spectrum, where they are treating every entity in a mesh as a sort of separate object. So, for instance, and each of those objects has their own boundaries and information associated with that. So, as an example of that, if you're building up a mesh, then say a 3D mesh, then the components of that 3D mesh would be defined in terms of what other 3D subcomponents are in there. That may be elements, or that may be again 3D ensembles, etc. Their associated boundary information. So it's taking a very sort of topological approach to the issue, which is appealing in one sense, that you can then sort of gather information, well-defined information about what are, for instance, the boundaries of a region. So you can specify or have a lot more information about how to impose boundary conditions or where to impose boundary conditions on a mesh. The downside, of course, is that it requires quite a bit more information. Essentially, you're taking a constructivist approach where your base entities are points. From those, you build up your 1D objects, which are segments or lines, right? And they have specified as boundaries, and typically sort of two boundaries for a 1D object. And then 2D objects are again defined in terms of the 1D boundaries that are associated with them, and then recursively with the 0D objects associated with that.
Do you think that's how they actually intend the mesh to be specified, or is that?
Well, that's what they state here in their sort of definitions. Whether they do that, by sort of storing all of it explicitly, or whether they do it by calculating, is up for grabs. They certainly say here, mesh entities are the fundamental building blocks of the mesh interface and correspond to the individual pieces of the domain decomposition for the mesh. Under the assumption that each topological mesh entity of dimension D is bounded by a set of topological mesh entities of dimension D minus 1, then the full set of mesh topological entities for an object, then the set of mesh entities of dimension D and lower.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's got to be a dimension D as well, because a mesh can be made up of separate components. And you can, that is a sort of a more rigorous approach that requires more information, but I don't think it is going to be excessive, in the sense that, you know, say if you think of regular 3D meshes that, you know, doesn't contain anything fancy, right? Say if you've got N 3D elements, then you're going to have in the order of 3N 2D faces associated with that, and in the order of what is that going to be? 3 1D elements associated with that. Once again, in the order of 0D elements. What's that?
Might be two because they're shared.
Yeah, well, that might be so, but it's not sort of rising exponentially or polynomial.
No.
The way you can achieve that is to try to store much of the information as templates. So an element, for instance, would contain the information about the as much as possible, the geometric information associated with it, you know, its vertices, the positions of its vertices, etc., and faces and lines. So, you know, just as we use in finite elements now, we have these templates or
is that like an element type?
Yeah, and there would have to be a distinction between what is an element, that is something that would be the end of your sort of tree for the topological definition, and something that is built up on top of those.
Okay. I'm not sure if I'm fully envisaging how a template works, so you somehow share some generic layout of, say, there'll be this number of surfaces in the front lines, and then...
Yes, so for a particular element, there would be a shape associated with that, and the positions of the vertices, the definition of the interior and boundaries,
right.
You know, the stuff that was already in the... So that's not changed anymore.
Okay.
But what you do, it does impose restrictions, because in this case you need to be pretty clear about the single dimension of the mesh that you're talking about. If you are trying to model interactions between meshes of different dimensions, then you know there's got to be some sort of glue. You need to treat those as entities, not a single mesh, because you run into major problems defining the boundaries of a mixed dimension object.
So you're saying that if you have a 3D mesh that's got the various surfaces, lines, point objects linked into the definition of that mesh, so you've got the hierarchy and the lower dimensional thing, that's entirely a separate object from, say, a separate 2D surface and 3D space.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But, you know, those are sort of special cases, I think, in the interest of making it easier to deal with analytically. I don't sort of have a problem with making those imposing those restrictions of saying a mesh is of a single dimension. because I think you can get around those cases where you're having mixed problems by, you know, maybe proposing a separate interface object that allows essentially different problems to interact.
But your mesh and fixed dimension and the highest dimension of the object.
Yeah.
And everything of lower dimensions is something to do with boundary conditions. Applying boundary conditions on your high dimension.
As far as the problem goes, yes, the fields are defined over that measured dimension n, right? And the boundary conditions are defined over that the boundary of it. So, you know, the sort of thing that you'll end up with is a, for example, so we've got a name here and a dimension, right? So that applies to that whole entity that is named there. And then you've got children, right? And those are a ensemble with the restriction. So this is a so that is a ensemble, right? So this is ordered, okay? And you have here a restriction. Dimension has got to be equal to n, right? And then you have...
So we know later why it's ordered?
Well, yeah. Yeah, maybe it doesn't actually have to be a set as well.
Okay.
And then the boundary again is, for example, but in this case here, but then you need to have some, you know, just as we had earlier on, some sort of way of linking it. And this would be a set of rules or a set of association that describes how the children are sharing resources. So as a sort of an example of that, just as an aside too, an ensemble that doesn't have any children is essentially an element. Just an easy way of identifying. But so that we can treat the elements and ensembles in the same way, just sort of.
So when you refer, say, by the boundary to another ensemble, does that ensemble itself have another complete definition?
Yes,
the object.
Yes, so it's recursive. Yeah. And I think that's, again, in the interests of trying to share as much information as possible. And treat, well, ultimately boundary conditions are acting on a, they define fields on an ensemble that just happens to be defined as the boundary of a higher dimension.
So how do you deal with the case of a coronary embedded in a 3D myocardium where the coronary is a n-2 dimensional mesh that links? How would you define the relationship between material points of that mesh?
Yeah, so that, you know, that is one of these issues where you have problems that are acting on manifolds or meshes of different dimensions. So, I mean,
this is your tying condition.
Yeah, that's how I would get around that, you know, by saying, well, there are specific, perhaps in this case, there are specific points at which the 1D coronary mesh interacts with the 3D myocardial mesh.
Couldn't you just specify the node points as in the coordinate space of the part mesh rather than the real world coordinate? So it doesn't have any definition apart from the definition of its embedding mesh.
Yeah, but that's not dealing with the issue of how they interact, though. That's giving the a convenient way of saying how you define the geometry of the coronary vessels with respect to a myocardium, which is moving. And yes, that's how you, you know, how you do that. But what Peter is saying, you know, what if you've got some variables that are shared? For instance, pressure fields on the coronary vessels. How do they then interact with the pressure terms in the and the myocardial lesion? So in that case, you could do that point-wise by saying that the you know, the fields interact at these positions. I don't know how you would do it in a higher dimensional sense by saying, well, we know the pressure along elements in a coronary vessel. How does that tie to the pressure variable in a...
In the end, you know, you'd probably always be evaluating at particular points, like a Gauss point.
But it still needs some interaction. It's easy to do if it's only a point-wise interaction.
Yeah, but then you probably would apply a point-wise interaction, but they would not necessarily be the node points.
If you're doing third-party, you might do some Lagrangian scheme where you sort of track back assessment and the Lagrange collision, where you take a point we want to integrate, but you actually track back where the fluid was at the previous time step, and that's when boundaries and things start to become quite useful.
So you're essentially using a method of characteristics?
Yeah, that's right.
To track these since the last time step. So Paul, you're saying that something like a coronary, even if it's defined, as Greg says, with coordinates that are relevant to the, related to the heart mesh, it's still an entirely different ensemble, and you're separately setting up the interactions between the two meshes.
Yep.
There's no link within the definition of your myocardial ensemble. No reference to the coronary ensemble.
No, I don't think there can be. Well, unless you add some extra information, I don't see that there needs to be until you start to specify the interactions in the problem definition. In one case, you certainly have the coronary mesh sort of embedded, because its coordinate systems are defined in terms of a field which happens to be specified by the, on the myocardial mesh. I think that's a slightly, that's a sort of a higher order issue that we can deal with. So I'm just running through some really simple examples, but if we have a 1D element, right, or 1D mesh, should I say, and this is just going to be build up a mesh. This is a little bit incomplete because there needs to be some information about the positions of these, and I haven't included that in there. Sort of doing this independent of the coordinate system for the time being.
But does that get stored in ensemble E1 or ensemble P1 and P2?
I beg your
pardon? That position?
It has to be an ensemble E1 because it's related to the higher dimension entity here, right? Points don't have coordinates.
But if P2 was shared with E2, then you'd have two ensembles with two independent definitions of the position of P2.
That's right. And that's why you need to add some information here in this ensemble that gives information about the positions of the entities that are there. Okay.
So you're saying you only specify fields or elements and that's why points don't make positions, is that the logic?
No. Points are zero D elements.
The way to create their own fields find them.
Certainly they could, I think we're confusing the idea of coordinate here. I think what Greg was talking about was the coordinates with respect to
size 0 and 1.
Yeah.
Right.
No, so that needs to be added. It's not in there.
It's XYZ.
No. In that case, that's entirely defined by the fields that are specified over the line. So
that line is just added in for us.
I just want to give it a little bit more thought. I can stick it straight in. Yeah, so
the record there that says what the local coordinates of P1 and P2 are.
Alternatively, you have a template, I guess, that says that these two boundaries are at size 0 and then size 1.
I mean, it may come in, through this here.
The links there mean adjacent ensemble.
This, yes. It basically specifies what objects have been shared in this ensemble. Right? Nothing's really been shared apart from these points, perhaps. But when you start to link objects together, then that's where this is going to be specified. So if we just hold off for just an instant on the just sort of note that is missing. So let's go to a much more complicated mesh. I'll try and use the same. This is a template, so this is where the element sort of information comes in, but we can use ensemble as a template as well. I'll just do that for the time being. P1, P2, and we'll call this one element 1. Similarly. So in this case here, that these, you know, don't need to be specified explicitly, that we can have explicit definitions through templates. So, association, so P1 is associated with P1.P1, etc. P2, once again, the association of the positions of these points in the sort of element definition, then we've got a pretty well-defined mesh being set up. We know that through these associations, we've got three handles associated with this object, right? And that P2 represents a shared resource that links down to the other level.
How much of what you're describing here is the same as what TSTT is doing?
What I read out is pretty well what TSTT has specified. I haven't been able to find any question about it.
So, sort of within that, so you've added your own
Yeah. And, you know, what I'm trying to do here is run through some examples where, you know, we can try to sort of see how difficult the meshes can be dealt with.
Are things like basis function and relation also contained elsewhere?
They are certainly contained elsewhere. This is really just the mesh definition. The basis functions, I don't think, are sort of changed. But, you know, it's sort of like a separate section in that sense. You know, that was detailed in the Yes, that's right. TSTT has a separate field specification as opposed to the mesh.
So if you have you would just here be defining basically the endpoints.
Yep.
What if that was a quadratic element? Three points.
So yeah, and if you needed to add sort of extra terms, I'm not sure how you do that. Whether that, you know, gets sort of stuck on to the ensemble definition, or whether that should be purely dealing with you know, boundaries. In which case, sort of internal nodes is something a little bit separate.
But I don't understand that. But why can't you have another form within your first ensemble which has a P3 at an internal point specified in terms of its local coordinates?
Yeah, that would be one way of doing it. But I think you also maybe would like to have the facility sort of further down the line to add ensemble points.
Right, gas points.
Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, where you have one 2D mesh joining up to another 2D mesh, right? This might be defined in terms of, nodes at, or both of these may be defined in terms of nodes at the vertices. But when you come to join these together, you want to have the facility to essentially add a point of interaction between those two boundaries. And I think it's too much to say, well, that's going to be done down at the element level, so we have a separate element definition. It's something that ought to be able to be done at the ensemble level as well, where you are joining two ensembles.
Just so you can see that the case of a quadratic element is a bit more sort of basic in the sense that your basic function makes use of that for all.
Yeah,
so I suppose it comes down to, would you want your very low level template ensemble, which you've done now, to be the template used for all 1D, or would you have a number of different templates, one of which is 3 numbers?
Right.
Then again, can you use this quadratic element?
You know, the construction of this thing here, if you can add points at this level here, you can certainly do it down at that level as well. What I guess I was arguing was that you certainly need to be able to do it at this level here, rather than have to do it down at the element definition. So, you know, in this case here, we have sort of a little bit of a interesting problem, because say on this mesh here we have defined part of the boundary as being we could define the boundary as being this line segment here, which itself is an ensemble that is made up of these two line segments here, right?
That would be the boundary of that domain?
Oh, the domain.
Yeah, cool.
Okay. You don't have to do it that way. You could leave these as two separate boundaries and just include them in the boundary set.
Or would it either off itself as to complement to like some functional work and minimize the difference between the two?
Yeah.
So you don't really have to worry too much about the fact that there's some intermediate mesh.
Right.
You expect there's a functional representation of the solution on the two boundaries, and you're just minimizing the difference between those two, so you can get whatever points you want to.
Right.
And like the principle could make this piece simpler instead of trying to actually have a mesh.
I think you need to be able to do both, though.
Yeah.
Essentially, if you wanted to keep the mesh separate and only communicating through a some sort of functional glue, that's great if you want to solve problems on separate processes and try to only deal with the interactions as a some sort of residual and try to minimize it without them. But I also think that this is an issue that you need to sort of sort out at the meshing stage as well. If you want to join these to form a single mesh, then...
There's a lot of work done on it for meshes that kind of match.
Yep.
The technique I just described isn't necessarily one from the process. As a matter of fact, most of us are for single process or simple problems where two squares can be measured that are not aligned.
Yep.
And they typically handle it in that type of way.
Yep.
It is one big mesh, but they don't worry about. There's handle the interface.
Yeah, I mean, where you have another example of where that occurs is where you've got sort of embedded meshes. Typical one is, one that's defined around a earlier on and that's then embedded in a much larger rectangular mesh or even a different scheme. And you specify the interactions between this mesh and that mesh through a series of points that either have to conform or you have to sort of minimize the difference between them.
Do we want to take a title of this?
I've got an exit version.
Oh, cool.
I haven't got the top quality.
Well, it's still a work in progress.
Can I get your feelings on the impression that there's two true details in the TFTP specification?
Do you build on that? Do you know any more than the
No, I mean, I know some of the ideas of being a more or less omnibus, where it's the way they come at it is more what I'm familiar with than the way you guys come at it, more of a computer science point of view. But I don't know the details behind the TFTP.
It may be in order to get the information, you've got to sign up and.
Yeah, this stuff that I work here on field specs and things like that. What's your feeling for the sort of manner or input for this group? Is it worth trying to stay consistent with them because other people are going to start following this group too and we will benefit from interoperability? Do you have a feeling for how powerful this group is for this group? Let's try that.
I mean, I think they represent
it's a DOE-sponsored grant to try and improve interoperability among the various labs
okay.
to become customization for how meshes are handled.
Okay.
So
the project
could be the current trend, but I don't know how long it's been being worked on. I know they've been trying to accomplish something like this for a while, so...
Yeah.
I mean, there are probably a lot of people working on it that have a lot of experience on building large software projects.
Well, TerraScale Simulation Tools and Technologies, there's some of... quite large groups associated with it.
The people working on it are obviously looking at the world. You know, they're going to kind of catch on for that or not. They won't like the code they're using, so,
Okay. If we want the details, there are two ways. Either we should try and email them and talk to them, or get on the discussion list or something, or we could look at one of their implementations of the database that currently is written to handle parallelization but doesn't handle our hexahedral meshes that we wanted. But perhaps we could extend their code to handle that. We also don't want to worry too much about jumping on a project that's going to stop in a couple of years. It's hard to make decisions.
Well, I'll see if I can join up and get some more information.
Okay. Sounds good.
For those of you who are interested, this version 0.7 is a relatively recent draft, I think the end of last year. certainly goes over the philosophy, the approach that they're taking, but as you say, it doesn't have a lot of details. So it actually deals with interfaces, but not the sort of underlying data structure.
So one thing it doesn't deal with is what seems to be like the coronaries within the heart and data missions.
But that, I think, is a higher level problem. You know, that is something that is defined not at the mesh level, but at the sort of field level. You start to define coordinate fields.
How much do you imagine being field analysis serialization? You know, once you've got these definitions and the data structures, and then you could presumably create a field ML file which not only the definition of the autonomous, but the interface in the field, the geometric field, all being transferred across to a single field ML file.
Although I would imagine that a good deal of the information is, would be set up as libraries, elements. Shapes, for instance, places, function types.
Essentially, you're using the same template for everything from these low-level element libraries right up to complex structures.
Yes,
but you could output a field-ML version at any level. So you could have a field-ML version of your single element, or you could have a field-ML file representing a very complex hierarchy of embedded structures.
Where the lower level details are probably handled by imports.
Right. It should also be importing all the information about the nodal tricky field position.
So in most cases, for instance, you would have I would imagine in many cases you would have a mesh that is have serialized and stored as a separate file that is then imported into the definitions of various fields that may be either stored separately or in the same file. But because they share either the same mesh or derivatives of the same mesh, then you'd want to have provision to import those definitions so that you can avoid having to duplicate.
So the import essentially becomes a pointer to that analyze.
I'm referring to import here as in the same way that we do in CellML, where it essentially acts as a template but creates a separate instance of the data. Just as you set up an element template that gets reused.
But then you are duplicating.
Not necessarily, because if you import it several times, then you're saying that as far as this level goes, there are multiple instances of that same template. Whether you then expand that out into the data structures that get duplicated for each of those instances, or whether you be smart and say, well, we're not going to duplicate all this information, we're rather going to get that information via function calls or something like that. So you don't have to do the sort of large duplications. It's really up to the implementation. So just as we do that with, say, element definitions in CMIS at the moment, I think what I've been trying to do here is to be able to do that with ensemble definitions as well, to avoid having to do the duplication.
But when you import a template and you import it a number of times, and yet you're saying that if you're smart, you don't replicate all the information associated with each of those, but you are saying that you're replicating the data on top of, you are actually reproducing the records, the types of information that will be held, or is it a single point? Did you just say, you know, element number one, number two, number three, they're all the same element of types?
Yeah.
And now they're pointing off to the information about the topology of that element.
Yeah.
So that single pointer is all you've got, that single structure.
Yeah.
You've got to have a single statement about that pointer.
And then the stuff that makes it different is held in the file from which the import is performed. So, for instance, you know, one case would be you would have say shared nodes, okay, or shared resources. They would be defined in the file or the serialization that is doing the importing, but the names associated with them will be done in that file to the names associated with, say, the element level objects that they're referring to. So that's where the links comes in, but the definition, say, for the topology and the sort of underlying structure of the elements, then is stored in a separate file. So although you're importing it sort of multiple times to create E1 and E2, there is only a single definition of it external.
You happy with it?
Yeah.
We were trying to work out how we're going to start developing and what possible sub-projects we could work on. I think there were two areas where Kristen and I saw eye to eye. One was a matrix vector multiplication, and it's something we could investigate how people do it and work out our own if it doesn't match our structures that we need to use. The other was the sort of you throw some cell models out, which is a very simple parallelization, but at least it's somewhere to start. The area you follow the discussion on the name list, but the area where we'd seen things quite differently, where I was hoping we could use sort of a distributed database to access our information, so that most of the code is written in a fairly sort of in a way that didn't know too much about how computation was going to be distributed, and your distributed database would handle caching and automate some things for you, but then you're going to want to optimize that, and so I'd imagine the way to do that was to include some explicit directions for where to store information, where to cache information, where to keep it up to date, and so forth. If I understand Chris correctly, he sees a domain decomposition algorithm and splits off various parts of the computation. Then each individual part thinks it's just solving one problem, and it actually doesn't know about the rest of the domain, but it's written like a serial code as if it's just solving, say, the diffusion over a subdomain. And then I guess the whatever the part that gathers the relevant pieces back together handles boundaries and so forth like that. So they're two quite distinct approaches, and neither of which I've experimented with. The term ghost nodes is something I should probably do research into and find out what it means, but can someone fill me in is a ghost just a case of a value elsewhere, or can someone tell the ghost what it means?
Typically, and one processor has these four
components,
so there's a four processors. And for this one to do a full matrix spectrum multiply, because there's a 5-point line of difference, there's a 5-point stencil here.
Okay.
So to update the, to do an A times X, to get the new right hand side value at this grid point, we need to know the solution here, 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 and here.
Okay.
So you typically put a ghost layer. So the one processor really would have 4 points, it would have 9 points. And the three, and the ones on the outside of the ghost layer.
So it sort of has your older values of those points?
Well, it's seeing what a matrix spectrum multiply, it's actually the current values.
Because it's explicit.
It's essentially duplicating memory that exists on the other processors.
Okay.
So it's a layer that reaches out, it depends on how long your stencil is, but if it's a 5.5 difference, it reaches out.
Okay. So
one measurement.
This is equivalent to a case of the value at that node, but put in such a way that it looks like it's a local mesh?
Probably think about that, yes.
Okay.
But that's why, in a way, you can just think of that as being a local problem.
Okay.
You just have your stencil representation. So this grid point here, you never do the matrix spectrum multiply for this grid point on this process. You do it on this process.
Because it's kind of the boundary.
Processor here has the ghost layer around it also.
Yeah, excellent.
So that's why you do a conjugate gradients. You do one iteration, and the solution changes, and then the ghost layers for ultimately be out of date, so that's why you need to update information.
Okay.
So that's where solve each iteration requires one ghost layer update.
Okay.
To do exactly as a serial CG would.
Cool. And the way things are normally done is that you calculate sort of your new values of your whole ghost layer, and then you send it all at once, and everything waits for the updates, and then you start again on a new subscale.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Cool, thanks.
You were worried about the cell crisis, right?
Yeah, well, that was what it was.
Chris was talking more about the whole thing.
Yeah, so this is probably more for your lip-busting.
Yeah.
Isn't that sort of thing dealt with, you know, with say PET-CT or some other?
Okay.
You probably need to issue a command to do that.
Yeah.
And update. But there's a PET-CT command that does the update. So once you've described your finite element grid, then an automatic ghost layer is placed around it. And typically it's always assumed you're doing linear finite elements, so that you know you only need one more layer, and that's where it becomes more difficult when you're doing
Hermitian.
And I guess you still, you just have not one degree of freedom here, but multiple degrees of freedom.
So we get more complicated with quadratic.
Right. That's actually probably the worst case.
Splines are probably the worst case.
Okay.
So that's the ensemble. I mean, how would you cope with that in the meshed ensemble thing if you wanted to indicate the associated ghosting points for a given sub-region?
So you're seeing another field defined on every, you know,
choose the message you want to put in that installation higher level.
Although I'm sort of kind of hoping that at least by specifying boundaries explicitly,
Calling those
lines that used to place between two ensembles.
So now you're dealing then with interior boundaries to your normal notion of it. When you're saying you'd set these divisions of the, if you're taking place the mesh across processes, you would make sure your ensemble reflects those internally created boundaries.
It's going to be dependent, the trouble is that's going to be dependent on the basis functions that you have for your fields as well, not just, you know, one field but all of the fields. So how far you need to, so how many, or which degrees of freedom in one mesh needs to be ghostly is going to have to be worked out from the support of each of the basis functions associated with the boundary of that mesh.
So is this saying that any parallel, any distributed processing of your mesh and how you handle the relationship between the different parts of your distributed mesh is something that's dealt with at an entirely separate level from the definition of all your ensembles?
Yeah,
that's what I'm afraid of.
You have to use the information.
Yeah. Yes. But you need additional information.
Yeah, because you need isolation.
Okay, we've probably only got enough time to have drawn away the issues here. But follow the mailing list discussion and put your comments in as you feel. I mean, I haven't experimented with either, so I'm not strong enough to say this is the way to do it. This isn't. Perhaps we can start with the things that we do agree on, and then things will become clearer as we move on. The other thing I just want to draw your attention to is that we're going to need some sort of testing framework to have our sort of unit tests and so forth, and there may be some nice systems that already compile code and run it and take it through some things for us. So if anyone knows any of them, they'd be handy. And we need to pick what sort of make and autoconf type.
Do you address the language issue? Or is that kind of thing?
I got the feeling that we're going to use the language appropriate to the piece of code. When that was a separate database and computational engine, and I thought the data handling could be done in C or C++, and the computation could be done in Fortran. It's unclear at the moment. I think Chris sees the computation handling the data as well, and so it doesn't really fit in with that viewpoint on it. Okay, I think we're going to have time now, but there are the types of things we're going to discuss next week. Thanks.
So, I mean, I'm just wondering, you know, like, who is evaluating the capabilities of the existing libraries?
Pensky library.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. It seems fundamental to what we're going to achieve.
Hmm. And but if we start with the matrix vector, we'll find out what libraries currently do a matrix vector and how they do it, and maybe we'll get a feel of which ones do it well.
I don't think it's really a Corpus matrix vector. I think it's more of a package that does distributed data.
Okay.
So it's distributed data. And that distributed data defines the matrix vector.
Cool.
So it's more of how is all the distributed data handled, and how is the matrix distributed. That would be the package. So that's the one. But the problem has to be with it. Chris did some work on it a couple of years ago, but seems to be best for structured problems. So there's still some questions about it. Definitely, I don't think works for the mechanics. For the reaction diffusion problems.
was that it was born out of a finite difference approach, a structured mesh, and that probably the best thing is to learn lessons from how they did it, but not to rely on this kid.
I mean, they're focusing on a more specific type of problem where we have a wide variety of problems, different meshes.
Yeah.
Certain 1D problems to where 3D problems and higher order elements. So, for the reaction fusion, you could probably just use as most of our stuff is structured locally.
But are there no sort of distributed large scale algebra libraries that might be suitable?
There's a few on the
I know that some have been identified, but I don't know of any that have been sort of looked at seriously.
I had a suggestion for Chris because I use one of those elements. He didn't like it because the SourceForge website word is quite inactive.
Library. I don't want to push them out because I'm not going to spend a lot of money for this.
Simple circle distribution of data.
So I'll get back in
there. Yeah. Using a Fortran 90 framework. And I'll just go ahead.